Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, delivering clarity in a world of constant noise. We try to go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay with the stories that matter. And coming up in the next 30 minutes, Budget 2025, are big new tax increases coming down the pipeline. Does the furor around the Land Expropriation Act affect personal finance? We'll take a look at South Africa's intensifying student housing crisis. And a special extended edition of the program today as we host a 30-minute panel discussion asking this question. With excise taxes rising faster than inflation, could we be pushing legal alcohol out of the reach of consumers and fueling the illicit trade?
MoneyWeb at Midday for all your up-to-date stories.
As South Africa's economy struggles under the weight of mismanagement and inefficiency, there are now calls for government wastage to be curbed. With Budget 2025 just around the corner, will the Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana take a firm stance on fiscal discipline? And what talk of new taxes? A lot of reports swirling about today that there could be a potential move on value-added tax. I'm in conversation now with Musi Maimane, leader of Build One South Africa. Musi, welcome to you. Let's dive straight into the tax front if we can. What would a move on VAT mean for the country? And what are you hearing?
Well, certainly, what has always been common cause, and the best way I can explain this is that for every 1 rand that comes into South Africa, South Africa's fiscus, 22 cents of it is spent on debt, 60 cents of it is spent on the social wage, and the balance is on cost of employees as it pertains to civil servants. So the harsh reality of it is that we've now hit the zenith, if you like, of having wiggle room. We've got to come back to a point where we have to make some not only structural reforms, but tough choices about priorities. And therefore, in essence, the government feels that an increase in tax could be one way of extending wiggle room, but I would argue that that is actually not the place to go. What is crucial is actually ensuring that you cut on government wastage, you ensure that wasteful expenditure, particularly around municipalities, is eradicated, you reduce the size of the executive, and that would mean, in essence, that the subsidiary services that go into that, i.e. the multiple departments, extended employees, gets reduced, and ultimately ensuring that when it comes to priority, you are focused a lot on domestic matters relative to some of the work that we've been doing everywhere else. So I think, to me, the move in this budget has to be more, I'm looking to ask the question, what are the fundamental cuts that the government itself will take? Because equally so, you can't ask citizens to keep paying more.
The reality, though, is we do need a short-term fix. And I'm just wondering whether the finance minister has any option but to look at tax increases, also given the projected 10 billion rand collection shortfall.
Well, I think, in essence, one of the things that the Minister of Finance has always spoken about is that the debt to GDP ratio will get up to about 75%, will mature at that. And I'm not convinced that thesis holds. And if that thesis does not hold, it means that South Africa has to look at how to extend its borrowings. The short-term intervention on tax, if you increase VAT, sure, we're dealing with a low inflationary point, but it will be impactful, particularly on the cost of living for South Africans, who more than half of them are living below the upper poverty line. So I think, to me, it's a government that must look itself in the mirror rather than going after taxpayer money and looking to increase revenue on that score. The under-collection at SARS is fundamentally driven by the under-capacity of funding that went to SARS. So again, it's one of these things that if you make an appropriation of about 600 million rands, which was done last year, that went to extend the cabinet of the GNU, that money could have been better spent capacitating SARS so that actually the collection levels would be improved and better. And SARS needs to ensure that it has a strategy of increasing, particularly around ports, around import and export goods, so that it's much more efficient at that level. We improve its own collection ability.
No one's arguing that we need to cut government wastage, but you talk about working at provincial and at municipal level. Very difficult to get into those weeds, though.
No, I think that it is now, we've hit a point where I think everybody realizes the difficulties. And I think the president alluding to the idea of the review of the white paper on local government, this has been a long outstanding project. And now, again, if a government doesn't act when the warning signs begin, it almost becomes hard to do it when the red lights are on. And the truth of the matter is that municipalities have progressively been decreasing their ability to collect and by extension, unable to finance to pay back their debts on Eskom and bulk services. So my proposal is that actually what we need to do is create digital ring fencing mechanisms that may that force municipalities to say on the sale of electricity, on the sale of water, there will be a direct collection and a direct settlement that goes in between the entities that are concerned. Because as things stand at the moment, if you just keep allowing municipalities to collect and you hope they will pay for bulk services, much of that isn't happening as we see the ballooning of the Eskom debt and the collapse of water boards and ending up with cities without water. So what we really need to do now is digitize collection and supply and payment of bulk services so that we eradicate wastage and leakage as it happens in the system.
Let me pivot in conclusion from the budget to party politics. Is your party going to throw its lot in with Action SA's smaller party umbrella plan?
The idea has always been and that we need to form a collective alliance that sits in the ballot in 2026 so that we can give South Africans an alternative. To create that, you need all parties to come to the table as equals so that you can put forward a compelling offer to citizens, because citizens actually want collaboration. And that's what BOSA has been working on with all a number of parties. When one party seems to say, well, it has to be their way or the highway, that undermines the spirit of collaboration and ultimately ends up in a space where you're not offering voters anything new, you're just offering voters one party, except it's be bolstered by a whole lot of others, which is not helpful. Actually, what we need as South Africans is a credible alternative that sits in the center, that articulates the views of citizens who say, look, I'm a non-racial South African. I actually want a mixed economy. I want an efficient party that works for all of us, and particularly in municipalities, we're tired of post-coalitions that end up with compromise and actually people being given positions that we don't understand. What we're desperate for is actually a pre-coalition that tells us exactly what it is going to do so that when I give my mandate, I also know how to hold that mandate to account on those parties.
So have you said to Herman Mashaba, thanks but no thanks?
I have said to Herman Mashaba, I would like to discuss equality amongst a number of parties. And if he's open to that, that's a discussion we must continue to have.
Musi Maimane is the leader of Build One South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the signing of the Land Expropriation Act has sparked intense debate, sometimes very vociferous, both locally and internationally. Some argue it's a necessary tool for redress. Others fear that it could destabilize property rights as well as financial markets. And I want to ask Warren Wilkinson now from Momentum Consult if this act is really posing a risk to investments or is the panic overblown. So, Warren, a very warm welcome. And as I mentioned in the introduction, there has been a lot of debate about this and a lot of rhetoric, a lot of invective. Have investors or how are investors and financial markets reacting to the new law in this country? What's the general sense?
Yes, I think, there's obviously been, depending on who you talk to, it's either been a better late than never silver bullet that'll obliterate land inequality and right South Africa's historical wrongs, as we all know. Or the biggest threat to our constitution and a throwback to apartheid's ugly displacement laws, So from what we've seen in terms of the signing of the new Expropriation Act, which repealed the Expropriation Act of 1975, we've seen a clear response, again, some good, some bad. But, our president has responsibly sort of repositioned the purpose, citing the country's core values as peace and justice, equality and solidarity in a non-racialistic and a democracy that looks to serve every South African. So I think it's very easy and very understandable for the consumer out there to get frustrated, to get nervous and to get very, very concerned about issues, especially when it comes to land. And so we've certainly seen a lot of emotion out there in the market.
And there's a lot of opaqueness at the moment, given that the Democratic Alliance is now taking this entire act to court. That is going to create even more uncertainty, which is going to have an impact on the way in which people feel about their investments.
Well, yes, absolutely. And I think the one critical element for me and for us, to be reminded of is the fact that our constitution already provides for a measure of expropriation. In fact, it is quite specific in the way that it deals with the willing buyer, willing seller approach, which is widely used, since the post 1994 land reform policy. I think we all need to be reminded that it's not arbitrarily going to look at expropriating land when it's not necessarily in the public interest or for public purpose. And I think it's also important for us to be reminded that expropriation is not something that is unique to South Africa. You know, there are many other countries around the world that's got similar processes in place. And I think the biggest concern and probably where most of the frustration has been focused on is the whole issue of no compensation within the new Expropriation Act.
And none of this, of course, is aided by the intensifying political rhetoric in South Africa and the strong stance that's been taken by the Trump administration.
Yes, I think there again, maybe he jumped the gun a little bit in getting some information that wasn't necessarily within context. As I stressed in my article recently, the important thing is always a little bit of context and a little bit of, a broader understanding of our landscape as a country. And one can understand, Jeremy, that there's enormous frustration in terms of the progress that we've made in terms of redressing the ills of the past. And one is understandable when one talks to, individuals who are still to this day waiting for land to be provided back to them. And again, just in terms of common international policies, most democracies require this fair compensation element. Unfortunately, the Expropriation Act doesn't define what that process necessarily looks like in terms of ensuring that when there's ever going to be a discussion around nil compensation, what is that going to look like in practice? And I think that's probably where the politics the legislation is going to evolve around, is to see how in practice they actually deliver on ensuring that land is not expropriated for the wrong reasons and without proper consideration for a willing buyer, willing seller scenario.
So against that then, what should investors be doing to hedge against this uncertainty?
Jeremy, I think for a long time now, and it's been preceding this current scenario where we're dealing with the sort of highlight of the expropriation conversation, we've seen a lot of clients over the years look a bit more constructively in terms of broadening their asset base on a global basis. Our children are all becoming global citizens. We've got baby boomers and Gen Xers that are busy retiring with an enormous amount of wealth transferring to the next generation. So for a lot of our families that we work with have got offshore interests, they've been a lot more focused in ensuring that they ring fence their assets away from the South African context in terms of their asset base, and ensuring that from a tax efficiency, estate planning and a risk management perspective, they grow their assets across jurisdictions and around the world. So it's not necessarily anything new, but understandably it does bring that element of concern and to see from a governance perspective how this act is actually going to be delivered over time.
Warren Wilkinson, franchise principal and financial advisor at Consult by Momentum. Thank you very much indeed. And this is the Monday edition of MoneyWeb at Midday. And just to remind you, a special extended edition of the program today as we host a 30-minute panel discussion asking this key question: with excise taxes rising faster than inflation, could we be pushing legal alcohol out of the reach of consumers? And if we do that, are we fueling the illicit trade in liquor? That's a special panel discussion coming up in around 15 minutes' time. I'll be joined by Nadira Grimsel-Gradwell, SAB's Regulatory Public Policy Director, along with Wendy Alberts, Chief Executive Executive Officer of the Restaurant Association of South Africa, and Lucky Ntimani, who is the convener of the National Liquor Traders Council.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, green hydrogen is hailed as a clean fuel of the future. It offers a pathway to decarbonize industries like transport and manufacturing. However, recent analysis suggests that we may not as a country be just ready to produce it at scale. I think the challenges are high production costs, infrastructure deficits, and also the need for substantial investment. And all of this poses significant hurdles. I want to dig into this a little bit more. I'm in conversation now with Professor Craig McGregor, Director of the Solar Thermal Energy Research Group at Stellenbosch University. Craig, a very warm welcome and thank you very much for talking to me today. The challenges that I've just mentioned in preventing large-scale green hydrogen production in the country, is that how we stand at the moment, and is there a way around this, do you think?
Jeremy, thank you. So it's a very complicated thing. The problem is green hydrogen is just so expensive. It's equivalent to paying $400 a barrel for oil or 10 rand a kilowatt hour for your electricity. So that's not something that people really want to do.
But it's being touted as a savior to the energy problem in South Africa. Are you suggesting that it's still a long way off?
I think we're talking a long way off. We have a lot of progress we can make in other opportunities, Jeremy, such as solar and wind power that are competitive with alternatives, whereas green hydrogen isn't. So we should be going to those options first.
Have you crunched numbers, Craig, in terms of the level of investment then that is required to establish a viable green hydrogen industry in South Africa?
It's horrendous amounts of money, Jeremy. I haven't actually looked at the full investment for South Africa. At the moment, we can't see a viable pathway to get there without substantial subsidies from into green hydrogen. And, you know, those subsidies would either need to come from the South African government, which we know, you know, is very, very constrained, or come internationally.
So I'm also hearing you say then that we need to start ramping up our efforts as far as solar energy is concerned. Are we doing that apace?
No, there's a need to accelerate that for sure, Jeremy.
And how do you go about doing that?
I think there, you know, we get into the position where the country is opening up its energy infrastructure. The IRP by the government has, you know, provided opportunities. It's, you know, there's a market that's starting to develop. So we need to promote all of those things.
Do you think there is sufficient government policy or regulation in play, either facilitating the rapid acceleration of solar power or, for that matter, green hydrogen as well? Is there a sense that there is a plan on the table here?
So I think the government is very well positioned in terms of aspirations. They want to expand in these areas. I think it's a bit more where the tire hits the road that the problem is, that the policy framework might be there, the implementation is lacking.
Is there a link between renewable energy capacity, Craig, and its ability to influence the potential to produce green hydrogen down the line? In other words, is there a symbiotic relationship between the different platforms of renewable energy?
So for sure, Jeremy, green hydrogen depends on renewable electricity, so solar and wind to be produced. I mean, the definition of green hydrogen is it's produced from green electricity. So you need to start with that. And as we've discussed, we're very far behind with the deployment of wind and solar. So until we've got a good portion of our grid on green electricity, we need to focus there rather than trying to make very expensive green hydrogen.
Are you suggesting, Craig, that we need to shelve our aspirations as far as green hydrogen is concerned, or just slow things down?
I think it's more about being realistic with our intentions, Jeremy. We need to green hydrogen, as you started in your introduction, has a very important role to play, and we mustn't lose track of that importance. But we must realize also that it's not something that's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. So we must be planning our investments and our strategies, but focusing on the important things like wind and solar. Mm. that we can implement now.
I'm interested in the investment side, though. We've seen a recent 32 million euro grant, I think it's 32 million euro, from the European Union in advancing South Africa's green hydrogen initiatives. Given the high costs of implementation and production, as you've suggested to me, is this useful or just a drop in the ocean?
I don't think to call it a drop is even maybe too a bit big. One of these, you know, if we're talking about what the European Union is trying to do with green hydrogen, one of these facilities would cost roughly 1 billion euros. So that's both the renewable, and that's just the hydrogen component, not talking about all the renewables, the wind and solar you need. So 1 billion euros is a lot of money, and we need 20 or so of those, 20 to 40 to get to the European targets for 2030. So it's massive quantities of money. The subsidy or seed funding is really around just doing some initial paper studies. It's not going to get very far.
The sense I'm getting is it's a long timeline for South Africa to become a competitive player in the global green hydrogen market. I've been in conversation with Professor Craig McGregor, Director of the Solar Thermal Energy Research Group at Stellenbosch University. Craig, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, thousands of students are left without safe and affordable accommodation as universities continue to grapple with a severe accommodation shortfall. We've had reports of students sleeping in lecture halls, falling victim to housing scams, and all of this is highlighting the urgency of the crisis. But the question is anything actually being done? To be perfectly honest with you, this is not a new question. I'm going to talk now to Benedict Johnson from the education financing company Fundi, and I want to discuss the real impact of this crisis and maybe if there are any new solutions on the table. So, Benedict, a very warm welcome. How severe is the shortage of accommodation in South Africa? Every year it seems to get worse and worse.
Yeah, no, it's getting worse and worse, but government has obviously shown strong commitment to increasing the student housing. So in 2020, there's been a shortage of about 500,000 beds. I know over the last years, they said that will increase to about 780,000 beds. So yeah, that is what we're facing. I know government has launched a student housing infrastructure program that we're looking at delivering about 300,000 beds over the next 10 years. But yeah, so that is where we find ourselves today.
But it's not really keeping up with the immediate demand that exists right now.
No, it does not. Because obvious across campuses, there's increased registrations. So when that increased, the demand also increased from a bed size. So yeah, it's really, we all have to look at this. And I think there's not a lot of reporting around it. That's why it doesn't really get a lot of attention.
The result of the shortage and increasing shortage is that so many students fall victim to accommodation scams, which in itself is a tragedy given how vulnerable they are at the start of an academic career.
Yeah, no, most definitely. I think you have students that comes from their rural areas into your urban areas and obviously seeking accommodation online. You never know, is it a true accommodation or is it a scam? And then people pay deposits just to keep that room, only to come this side and find out, no, that room was never, it was a scam. And you can imagine if people save a lot of money towards accommodation and sending that student to these universities, a loss for them of 5,000 or even 10,000 is a lot in a family. Yes.
And let's assume that they do find a bona fide place to stay. Often that student housing doesn't meet the necessary quality standards.
Yeah, look, from a university point of view, there's some universities that focus basically on off-campus, and they do the standards and norm checks in making sure that it does meet. Then you have the unregulated market. Obviously, trying to house 700,000 or even 500,000 students, universities doesn't have that capacity. So you will have these unregulated spaces. And you can imagine how that impacts also the students' studying at a university, because if his environment is not conducive to study, you can imagine the failure rate then is impacted. So there's a ripple effect across the board that we have to think about also.
Which, Benedict, then raises the issue, and this is where Fundi comes in, as to how private sector partnership can address the crisis. So is that working sufficiently and at the kind of pace that is needed?
No, so at this point in time, obviously we're working with some universities. We've developed a system which we call an unaccredited landlord system. Basically what it does, where students are housed in one, two, you know, at your house, one, two students at a house, we're trying to make sure that students can also be traced. Because at least it's the first step in making sure where a student at least stays. Because if a parent seeks and looks for his kid, at least you can go on that system and put in a student number and you can try and trace where that student was housed. So, and that we're working hand in hand with the universities to make sure at least you're bringing all that students that stays at all these unregulated places onto a platform that you can at least see where's the lease agreement. Yes, the university is also where the student stays. So that is at least the first step in the right direction. But obviously we need to accelerate everything that is happening around student housing to make sure we can deliver quicker.
So let's talk about that long-term acceleration. There is a government plan over the next 10 years, as you mentioned to me, but we need better, longer-term policies to prevent this crisis from accelerating.
Yeah, no, most definitely. I think a person made a suggestion. There's so many unused buildings that government owns that can be maybe revamped into student accommodation. I think we need to really come together and collaborate more in trying to get these solutions going. I know there was little progress so far in terms of the government program where they've started delivering some of these beds, but yeah, I think more conversation and more developers coming forward and working hand in hand with universities to see maybe universities got free land, developers can come in and develop and see with a partnership how they move forward. And I think that needs to happen now from this point going forward.
And all of this, of course, is contingent on the right support being available for students who are struggling to secure housing.
Yeah, most definitely. And from our side, obviously, all the accredited ones and off-campus ones that's secured for students, we've also got platforms that they can go on our platform and really search for those ones. But also the need is, the demand is so high, those accommodation places also get quick taken up. So we need really more intervention from private sector, more intervention from all stakeholders to get to a solution quicker than the 10 years that we envisage to deliver 300,000. Because maybe after that, how many do we still need to catch up? So we really need to get together and really discuss this topic and really get to solutions that we can implement quicker.
Do you think it's still solvable, or given the increasing backlog, do you think that we've now reached that pivot point where we're going to sit with this problem for a long time?
It is solvable. I think when you look at Johannesburg, there's a container accommodation close to Fortsburg that I've seen. So there's different solutions and different building. We don't need to go to the stand and mortar type of buildings that we've got. I think there is new technology out there. There is new ways of building quicker. And I think we need to investigate those type of things instead of going your usual type of how we deliver housing and so on. Because if you can get containers, those type of containers can be set up. And I know I've seen some of those ones in Northwest. I've seen some in Joburg. And we really need to investigate those quicker type of ways to try and turn around this situation that we're finding ourselves in.
Benedict Johnson from Fundi, thank you very much indeed. That is also our program for today. We are back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.